Hello everyone, I'm Jill Trebilcock and welcome to We Raw Radio. And I'm Jill Trebilcock, here today with our very special guest, Professor Stuart Twemlow, a psychiatrist, a psychoanalyst, a Renshi master, a prolific writer, and an expert in many things, but most particularly in what we're interested in is in bullying and the bystander effect. But today, Stuart and I are going to speak about how Stephen, we're going to have to cut that bit. Just write it down, all right? We're going to talk. So there's a gap. So today, Professor Twemlow and I are going to be talking about altruism and how to mentalize altruism. So, welcome, Professor Twemlow. We're very happy to have you here again. And welcome, Stephen Roberts, my producer. Thank you for being here too.
No problem. Great to be here.
Stephen, you here?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Jill. You're welcome.
You have lots of ideas about altruism, don't you, Stephen? You love altruism.
I thought Dr. Twemlow was the show here, Jill.
He is. I just have to include you. So, Professor Twemlow, let's talk about altruism. Can we live without it?
No.
But we can't live without altruism.
No. No way.
It's impossible, isn't it?
Yeah, and the reason, Jill and Steve, is that in our opinion, and I'm not reflecting the general opinion of the psychiatric population, although I am reflecting the opinion of many, many experts, we have at least three drives. Let me tell you what I mean by drive.
Mm-hmm.
In the animal world, there's a concept called instinct, which simply means what drives an animal to act in a certain way. For example, if you get too close to most animals, and birds, they will attack you if you're threatening their nest or their children.
Well, actually, a cat is attacking me right now because out trying to get my attention from you, Stuart. He's clawing my legs. Do go on.
That's not the same. What I'm talking about is when the animal is protecting its young.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It will automatically, if you threaten the young, it will attack you.
Mm.
That's called an instinctive action. It happens whether the animal likes it or not. It just sort of automatically goes. And there are a number of things that are connected with self-preservation.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of them. For example, an example in the human condition, and you could try this with a friend. Mm-hmm. Stand about 6 feet away from your friend, and then walk towards them very, very slowly. And at a certain point, you will feel they're too close to you.
Mm-hmm.
And my guess is that will be about 3 feet away.
Yes.
At that time, you're within their boundaries, and you can become a threat. So the natural tendency in human beings is to step back when you get closer than 3 feet. If they're paranoid, it may be 9 feet or 12 feet. We all have an instinct for territory. Now, what we're doing with this idea of altruism, which has never been recognized in any of the psychologies as a normal part of human interaction, what's happened is the analytic group have disavowed it. The group headed by Seligman, who is a professor of psychology, very expert in positive thinking.
Martin Seligman?
Yeah.
Okay.
They've adopted it as their own thing, something that, you know, Seligman thinks it's very important. Analysts don't think it's very important. So what we do, what we're doing, literally, as we speak, and that paper you got, I sent you Jill, and I hope you sent it on to Steve, is that the first step in a process to bring altruism into the psychological community, we are proposing that it is a drive or an instinct in one sense. When Freud talked about drive, he didn't say instinct. He said Trieb, T-R-E-B. In German, it means a drive, an impulse to do. And others, like Akhtar, have defined it as an impulse with a mental representation. In other words, it's not just, I do this without thinking. It's, I do this within my mind, there is a reason for doing it.
Yep.
Now, altruism is present in all primates. It's not confined to human beings at all. The vast majority of animals have a limit to the extent they will attack others that are not threatening them. The only exception to that rule is the human being, who will engage in sadistic activity, the pleasure of seeing other people suffer. One or two exceptions in the animal kingdom, you may be surprised to hear, are the dove, that we have sort of accepted as a symbol of peace. It would be the last symbol of peace I would ever choose. And the deer, little Bambi. But the duck and the deer are very cruel to others, really? Particularly their babies and others who are not surviving well. But what even animals like wolves that you will often see in horror movies, I think it's fair to say, to my knowledge, anyway, there's not a single death of a human being in North America ever from a wolf. They're highly moral animals. They just look scary. And when you can't fight, they will let you survive. All you have to do is give up.
Give your neck.
Or survive your expose your neck, yeah. Here it is. Go for it. No one go for it. Most animals will do things to help others survive. Whales, as you know, whales have to breathe. They're mammals. So if a whale is too sick to come to the surface, other whales get underneath it. Many examples of 8 or 10 whales lifting a sick whale to the surface so it can breathe. And there are many examples of altruistic action in primates. And the appreciation of altruistic action is astounding. For example, there was a whale off the coast of California that was trapped in huge numbers of nets and wires and fishing lines and all sorts of horrifying things that had bound itself up so it couldn't move. It couldn't even get to the surface to live, and it was drowning. And somebody observed it off the coast of California. This whale was making, you know, there was lots of spouts, and this thing was trying to stay on the surface, but it was so tied up with all of these man-made things, it couldn't breathe. So immediately a group of altruistic Californians went out there, I think there were 8 of them, with scuba divers. They got to the whale and they spent 7 hours disentangling the whale from its nets and hooks and chains and wires.
Yeah, that was just last week too, wasn't it?
That was fairly recently, yeah. And after it finally had been released, and these men were exhausted, you know what that whale did? It's amazing.
It kissed every one of them.
Man.
Yeah, I believe.
And nosed up to him like a thank you. Each one of the 8 had an individual meeting with that whale. He went to them and nosed them like, thank you very much. You saved my life. And here's an animal that we all think of as so primitive you couldn't even think of it as having feeling or having access to any awareness that it had been helped. These men, a number of them had religious experiences. They had life-changing experiences when they realized that whale was communicating with them. Its loving feelings for their altruistic action. And there's nothing more special than that, in my opinion, Joel. When you have a cross-species communication that says, thank you.
Yeah.
Now, you see, I think that's part of the human condition. I think there is a natural, automatic, inborn tendency to help others. And it gets submerged under sexuality and aggression. And it's never been recognized in psychiatry as anything other than some sort of defensive action by which the ego says, I'm not as bad as that. For example, theory of altruism in normal psychoanalysis is that it's a reaction formation against sadism. That is, to defend against your sadistic, horrifying desires to see people suffer, instead you become a holy man or woman.
So it's a sublimation.
So to defend against that.
Right. So it's,
Then somebody said, you know, that a little impolite when you think about Mother Teresa of Calcutta. It's not exactly what you would say, that Mother Teresa probably was a sadistic child who grew up into an altruistic woman to defend against her own wishes to hurt and enjoy the pain of others.
It's just not true, because we see it in little children. Little children do altruistic
Absolutely.
Things.
And you're right. So I'm just saying that now there are two sorts of issues around altruism. One is it's used defensively when you want to act as if you're much better than you are. Psychotic altruism, one person called that. That's when you get the TV evangelists in America, a lot of them.
I get it.
They have prostitutes and they do a deal in drugs and they're criminals, but they act towards the public as if they're some special example of altruistic action.
So that's a real schism in the psyche, isn't it? That's sort of because with the point at which they're behaving in an altruistic way, those people that you're talking about. They actually buy into that. It's a disassociation, is it? Like they buy into, I don't know what the word would be, but they buy into believing that they're kind just because they're doing kind acts, but they're actually acting out a role in their own mind, aren't they?
Well, they're acting to avoid their own nastiness.
So it's an avoidant thing. That's really interesting.
When altruism is an ego function. When it's an instinct.
Yes, that's right. That's the point I was going to make.
What?
That's the point I want you to make. Altruism is an ego function rather than as an innate drive.
No. Yeah. It's an ego function under certain conditions.
Yeah.
As every instinct is. Sexuality is an ego function. Aggression is an ego function.
Right.
What I'm trying to say is altruism, like sexuality and aggression, are not ego functions unless they have a function in that direction.
Yes.
The best example of pure altruism would be if you were standing on a wharf and a mother dropped her 1-year-old into the water.
Yep.
There's a very good chance, whether you could swim or not, that you would jump into the water.
Yep.
That's altruism.
Okay. What I'd like to grab you at this point, Stuart, I don't know if I'm allowed to read any part of the paper you sent me alive, but I did send you an email about this saying that I thought it was very interesting that you said that I actually can't the glorification of violence is a displacement of the wish to be altruistic.
Well, that's the paper I sent you.
Yes. And it was very interesting because I'm just trying to find the part in the paper because I didn't do it. But anyway, so basically what you said was that you think that it's a lot easier for the ego to glorify violence than it is to glorify compassion. And that was interesting because it was,
Hey, Jill, that's what I mean.
Jill, I've got a comment along that little sequence there that you just mentioned. I've always known for years that it's much easier to laugh at someone and call them silly or crazy than what it is to try to work out whatever the situation might be. Point the finger and tell somebody they're crazy, then it's much easier to do that than to try to work through some type of a situation.
That's a good example, Stephen, of the use of humor as a displacement technique.
Sure.
It depends on what you're displacing it onto, but as Freud said, you know, jokes always have a serious meaning. They are ways of relieving anxiety. And if you have a lot of anxiety about something, certain types of people, I'm one of them, tends to laugh rather than get serious and miserable. But I'm aware that laughing is a defense against crying. And the best example of that is black humor, which I find very funny.
I know, I'm a bit the same. I am the same. I do laugh at... I laugh if somebody tells me something terrible sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I think Steve's point's a good one. People use all sorts of defenses to displace their anxiety about a particular issue. My point here is that when you're one of these American, and this is an American paper, mm-hmm. obviously, it's not directed to Australians, it's directed to Americans. Yeah. And you're a chest-beating gorilla that needs to own a bazooka and half a dozen AK-47s, what in God's name do you need those for? As if the Indians are just around the corner.
Exactly. What in God's name have you become now?
And my point is, altruism in the West is considered to be, first of all, religious. And, you know, in America, religion is very unpopular in general. People are leaving churches in droves.
Right.
Secondly, feminine, that good works are done by women. They're the ones that do the all of the good work at school. They're the ones who serve in the homeless shelters. They're the ones who go out and put themselves out for people that need help. They're the ones that make sure their children are taken care of at school. They do all the good in the community. And the men earn the money and sit in a pub and talk about sex and football. I'm talking about America.
Yeah.
And thirdly, if you are too altruistic, if you talk too much about being helpful and nice to people and doing the sorts of things altruistic people do, your colleagues are likely to say, are you a pansy? Are you a wuss? Where is your manliness?
It's awful, isn't it? How did we construct that role for men that they're not allowed to be?
It was inevitable because
social engineering
in this country, a very huge country with massive economic power, power to destroy this world many times over, is only 200 years old, has no history, and was settled by people who were escaping from a crazy king, King George IV, I believe, who was very, very irrational about his use of taxes. And a lot of people left England to settle in a new country where they were not harassed by a crazy king. I mean, to put it in a very simplified way, this is a country that is in adolescence. If that, I think it may be about 11 or 12 year old.
I believe you.
It's likely to do things like glorify violence rather than think women can do the altruism and men can do the violence.
Well, this is the thing. And so rather than there being some sort of union oneness, and so in a lot of ways, women are a lot luckier than men in terms of spiritual development or opportunities, because they're more allowed to be themselves.
Yeah.
Or be in touch with all of those aspects. Though, mind you, if we get too tough, we're called bitches, or we've got balls, or we're pretty scary if we, you know, then men try and sort of defeminize us for being tough. So there is this really sort of allocation of, you know, the sugar and spice and, you know, and the guys are all rock salt.
Yeah. But you see, I think there are examples in other parts of the world where men can be altruistic without being feminine. An example I saw that I thought was typically British. You know, British, the way you can really piss off, excuse me, the way you can really annoy a British person is to call them a nation of drunks. The British have awful problems with alcohol. Awful.
Irish and Scottish too, yeah.
Yeah. And they're sensitive about it. Like when you call America a nation of people that like shooting and killing people. It annoys Americans to call them that, and it annoys the British to call them drunks. But listen to this. I read this in the New York Times. The typical British bobby, a male, will get out at 3 in the morning when the pubs close. All the young people come out on the street in freezing cold. This is wintertime, in their high heels and scanty clothing, and fall over because they're drunk. What they do in England is they drink at discount stores and get just about drunk on cheap liquor, and then they go to pubs where the cost of liquor is much higher, and they drink less, but they still are drunk by 3 in the morning. So they go out and they can't walk on their high heels, and they don't have enough clothing on because the weather is so freezing. So guess what the policemen do?
Have
they
sex.
They draw up in their little specially designed paddy wagons.
Yeah.
They bring out a set of flip-flops that
really?
The girls put on. These are flat-shoed soles.
Super shoes.
So they don't have to walk in their... In their high heels, they can walk without tripping over.
Really?
And then they're really drunk. They have these mobile jails where each cell is only big enough for one person, and they sit on a seat. And they are fully supported in that seat, and there is a little drain. They need to vomit or urinate. It they can do it in front of themselves, and it all goes out into a thing that catches all of their stuff.
Where's this in England?
I'm telling you, the British police force do that without being asked.
They're fantastic.
So, you know, that's altruism. They take care of the young. They also want to take care of the drinking, but. They don't.
Well, how can you?
We're surrounded by altruism if only we would let it happen. In my country, yours, Steve, yours and mine, we don't allow altruism to become something men can do.
Okay.
We simply don't.
So who are your role models?
I say it's displaced.
Because who are your role models, Stuart, in America?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sports heroes that take advantage of everything.
Absolutely. That's who.
Movie stars that take advantage of everything.
Absolutely. You see, my point is, if you let altruism emerge from you, it doesn't matter what your gender, what your religion, what your country, it's part of your human basis. It's the basis of your humanity, altruism, sexuality, and aggression.
Well, it's really interesting.
If you put them together, you will have a much better world. And at the moment, you know, people like, I'll tell you a person I think is on the edge, and I'll say this and probably everybody will disagree with it, on the edge of being altruistic is Vladimir Putin.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And who is really, really clever and thinking very carefully about how he's going to position Russia. I think he realizes that constant fighting achieves nothing. Nothing.
Or Russia
knows that.
Russia statistically is a lot more freer than America is right now.
In many ways.
Many ways.
And I think people like him understand that. And I don't think, I'll say this with criticism obvious, our President Obama is that aware of that. I don't think he has this long-term view that if you keep on fighting your enemy, you will get nothing. The Shogun saw this. The wars in Japan saw this. They entered in 1600. They realized that there's no point in that anymore. It doesn't achieve anything.
I've got a question for you, Dr. Twumlow. What makes greed push aside altruism?
You see, my feeling is Freud said all of these instincts, greed comes from the id, it's a drive towards self-satisfaction at the cost of everybody. His feeling was these drives were so powerful, nothing could stop them. I think he was wrong. I think greed only flourishes in a country that downplays altruism. The best example in the world, I think, is the United States of America. I think Russia is more altruistic than we are. And I think here we glorify Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, full of corruption, full of reporting investors as Muppets and stupid, having no ethics in business. If you're stupid enough to invest with me, you're stupid enough to lose your money. That's the ethics of business. I think that method is best exemplified in the United States of America. And it's
okay.
A country that is the least altruistic in the world, except there's so much money, it gives money to its enemies. There's no coordination with this at all, except Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, those are the two major ones under discussion right now, have people so rich they don't mind giving away a few billion dollars to Somalia or some poor country.
Bank of America has been circling the drain for about the last two years now.
But hang on, look,
I'm in a country
the id, the ego, and the superego. So what you're sort of saying here is that Freud thinks that the id is where the drive for greed comes from. But actually, I say, and you're saying you're not so sure about that. Well, I'm just thinking it probably is a libidinal drive or an ego drive. Or an id drive. It is probably a part of the id, but it's also superimposed in our society by the ego and the superego, because the society is telling us.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I think that what the id actually does in the culture is determined by the superego and the ego.
Yeah.
So we have Goldman Sachs and Bank of America.
Yeah.
Because they represent what is going on in our culture, the ego.
Yeah.
And the superego, the conscience of the business community is so primitive. I mean, to me, it's unbelievable. It literally is. If you're stupid enough to invest your money with me, you're stupid enough to lose it.
Right. So,
that's called ethics. That is. Yeah. But if you have that as superego, and the ego says, well, here are these people with money. They don't mind us taking it because they have no idea what they can do with it. We'll take it and we'll do our best to earn them some money. But if we don't, screw it, because they don't really know what they're doing.
Yeah.
That the dominance in our culture of sexuality and aggression.
Give me a few seconds, Jill.
Altruism has never been given a decent chance.
Yeah, Dr. Twumlow, I had a schoolhood friend, a childhood friend, about 15 years ago. He had a little company around my area here that was doing some investing in mutual funds and stuff like that. Him and his friends put on a little seminar and. Me and my dad had put, I think, $4,000 each into some mutual funds. And after about a year, we had about $4,100 to show for it. And, I said, hey, I'm going to go ahead and get onto this. And he said, well, I probably am too, because there's not much to do about anything. He said, what mutual funds basically are is robbing Peter to pay Paul.
That's right. I think you're right. And you see, but you get sucked into this idea that I'll put your money somewhere where it won't make much money, but it won't disappear. And the fact is it will disappear. And it does disappear.
Yes, it
and
does.
So people give money into people that lose their money.
If you don't have...
I did the best I could, but
yeah,
I'm sorry.
Okay, so how do you, was one use the ego and the superego to bring out the drives in the id?
Okay, here's what I propose.
For compassion and altruism.
I don't think we can match the ethics of the superego and the ego. I think we're stuck, at least I'm talking about America, it's not Australia.
Yeah.
I think here we really are stuck in this idea that people who give you money and don't understand how you're going to use it are stupid. What I want to see happen, and I've seen it happen and I've made it happen, is that taking people who live in bad situations and making them or encouraging them to be altruistic will change their lives.
Okay.
I'm literally starting next week.
Yep.
Right up the second grant. We have a $7 million grant. I'm writing another one to do exactly the same thing in the school system, Miami-Dade County, and in San Juan, Puerto Rico. All we're going to do is foster altruism. I'm not up to fighting Bank of America. I'm not up to fighting these monsters that have been created. What I want to do is just help people be better, kind to their friends, compassionate to their enemies, and see if they don't feel better, because I know they will. But they'll want to do it differently.
But what you really want to do is
overcoming the sexuality and aggression. I'm interested in evening up the role of altruism with sexuality and aggression, with the hope that eventually altruism will dominate.
It's sort of like, you know, compassion imbues everything, and eros and thanatos, sexuality and aggression. You know, when you say the word eros, people, or sexuality, people have a lot of trouble thinking it's not just about having sex. But what we're talking about, what I'm trying to say here is we need, and it's coming into our society, into the language of our culture more now, and that is about loving relationships and about loving deaths.
And not people about are, sexuality alone. It's philia. You know,
philia friendship,
the Greek sense.
Yeah.
It's the love of humanity. It's patriotism. It's working for your friends. It's trying to do things for people who don't have enough to live. It's taking seriously the plight of people. New York City last night had 53,000 homeless people in shelters. 53,000. That sort of figure is not acceptable.
And it's not acceptable.
I think that can change only by setting examples and setting in situations where you take people and change them in the way they see their neighborhoods and communities. Now, what we found that's weird is the very bad people, gangsters, really love being altruistic.
But that's a compensatory thing again, isn't it?
Well, because they never are before. One of them said,
"Oh, I see.
I felt like a cadaver, and now I feel like I'm slowly becoming human."
Yeah, from Thanatos to Eros again.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have a huge task to change our culture. And everybody that Obama in America hires, including recently a friend of mine, are experts technically, but they're not experts philosophically. And I think without the philosophical experts, this isn't going to work.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you can find on YouTube a speech by Obama on compassion and how America needs more compassion. Do you want to Google that, Stephen?
No, but it's called rhetoric, though, Jillian. That's
well,
what
it
it's
was
called.
Very well written. And okay, all right. I'm not going to fall in that hole.
The point I'm trying to say is that Obama is a technocrat.
A technocrat.
I think he really is. He wrote two books that sounded more philosophical and more deep. But his presidency has been one of moving from one problem to another, trying to change it in a way that won't piss everybody off or cause more trouble. He has not actually created an altruistic policy. If he gave me the chance to help him create an altruistic policy tomorrow, I would leave Houston and go to Washington, D.C. and spend the rest of my life there. Yeah, I know how to do that.
Yeah.
He doesn't.
Yes, so, I'm actually, yes, go on.
Can I say, you know, you and I are united, you through your role in Tibetan Buddhism and as a nun, your incredible experiences you accounted to me in your email of reaching and understanding the emptiness of yourself. Once you understand that, you have to realize that everything is empty of personal pride. It's all for the good of everybody. And that's what Tibetan Buddhism teaches. You saw it, you experienced it, you changed because of it. And I think I may have a way of changing some of these Goldman Sachs well, this sounds extraordinarily grandiose, but Goldman Sachs and Bank of America people, from a perspective of pragmatic altruism.
Yes, what do you mean exactly by pragmatic altruism?
That's what I mean by it.
Thank you.
Best example that I have in the United States is a company called Hallmark Cards.
Yes.
I know you have them in Melbourne.
No, I know the story, but people listening don't know it. You've told this story before. I love this story. That's why I'm smiling.
Well, Hallmark Cards is the fifth largest private company in the United States. It's entirely family owned. Its center is in Kansas City. It provides for its workers the best working conditions of any company I've ever seen anywhere in the world.
Yep.
People never leave Hallmark Cards. When they go to leave, they have their children coming in to take the place. Massive discounts on Hallmark product, which are just cards. They get the best health insurance in the world.
Yep.
Mr. Hall visits them every time they have a birthday.
Yep.
They are special people. They get time off for meditation. They get time off to do yoga. They want to take a break and go see their children's school thing. They arrange it at the lowest level possible. They want to take a vacation. They arrange it at the lowest level possible. It doesn't ever have to become part of what is in their listing. It's just something they do themselves with their colleagues.
Yeah.
What he's done is he's changed authority to be at the lowest level possible, which is a system invented by a management executive called Peter Drucker. It's called management by objective. And he's got the whole place operating with minimal staff supervising, and staff doing the job arrange their own cover, arrange their own special needs, like my kid is sick today. I have to be on school. Will you take care of my job and I'll take care of your job?
That's a really clever way of doing it, isn't it?
Now, let me finish.
Yep.
His people can go to meditate. They can go do yoga. They can take their time off. All they have to do is their job. If they do their job well and don't have to take special time to do it because they took off to go to yoga, they don't have to do it. They don't have to do any special hours at all. They just have to do their job. That's one of many, many companies in the United States who treat their workers very well and make a huge amount of money.
Yep.
So once again, we ask, where is the altruism? Why does Mr. Hall of Hallmark Cards, why is he an unusual person? I've got 7 or 8 of them I'm going to write up in a book.
Well, you've got it right here. You've got
their employees altruistically and made large amounts of money. So why is it that Bank of America and Goldman Sachs have to act this way?
That's right. And you've got, I'm just looking at your paper here. I've got it in front of me and I've got pointed marked out. And you were talking about this actually fits in sort of with Gandhi's term, where you join cooperatively rather than competitively. That's exactly what Drucker's talking about.
That's what Mr. Hall decided. He didn't know Drucker. He didn't know.
Oh, well, anyway.
I don't know if I told you how management by objectives was invented at the Menninger Clinic.
Oh, really?
Here's what happened. There's an analyst who every day at 3 o'clock, his alarm clock would go off, and it disturbed his patient and himself enough times to where he got annoyed about it, and he complained to the authorities, and they tried to trace down who who was setting his alarm clock at 3 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out it was not 3 p.m., it was 3 a.m. And that was being set by an employee hired to clean the offices. And it was set because at 4 a.m., the supervisor would come around and see if the offices were clean.
Right.
And if they were clean, he would let the worker go home 3 hours early. You got it?
Yeah.
And so that was the beginning of management by objectives.
Right.
The guy got off because he was working hard to clean the offices, and he happened to use this alarm clock to clean them, to make sure he knew when he had an hour left
to really speed up.
It was coming. There was Drucker picked that idea up and made it into a system.
Yeah.
Although it was invented at the Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas.
Yeah, because you often see that. Like, I have a cousin who works like a maniac, and he's so fast. You know, like, if you're paying people by the hour, and you paid, you know, somebody who worked sort of at my pace, depending on what I was doing, you know, you'd absolutely not want to pay people the same amount because, you know, some people just move really fast. So, yeah, so the moral to the story is if some people can fit it in a shorter period of time, they're still... should, you know, or in this story with Drucker, they were still paying them at the same rate for the number of hours it would take
at a normal pace. Drucker was suggesting if you can work fast, you can get off time.
Yeah, I got it, yeah.
The objective was the issue. It wasn't that it had to be 20 brush strokes a minute on the floor.
Mm. It was,
did you clean the floor?
Yeah. And look, I'm trying to stick
in management of workers. Yeah. And it opened up the possibility of altruistic action. And Mr. Hall took charge of that. Others, Lucent Technology is another example of a company that did this. There are a number of them in America who've made a lot of money by being very good to their employees. So my question to you or your audience is, why is it that you have to be like Goldman Sachs or Bank of America? Why do you have to be so unpleasant to people that you serve? Why can't you just be altruistic and they will help you out and do everything you want if you give them a good working environment?
Mm.
See, I think that is a sick part of the United States of America. I think we are caught in an illness that includes not enough awareness that people are humans and alive. What I call is subjectification of the object. The person you're talking to is not a Goldman Sachs investment banker. He's a human being called Harry that has been assigned to help you. And when I talk to people like that, I spend half an hour trying to find out who they are, where they came from, what their upbringing was, who their parents were, why they're in the job. And, you know, many times people like that think, what the hell are you acting like this for? It's nothing to do with what you're doing. And I say, yes, it is. Because I have to know you as a person before I'm willing to trust you as an individual that will invest my money. Is that unreasonable, Jill?
No, it's not unreasonable, Professor Stuart Twemlow. It's not unreasonable at all. I think it's very important. So you're just saying that basically that we're too mechanized in the way that we approach things, and we've taken the human element out of it. And by the word human element, we mean that interconnectedness. And, I mean, when you think about it, aggression and aversion is a repulsion. So how can you feel connected when you're busy aggressing or repulsing somebody?
Well, yeah, or treating them like Muppets or idiots or something. Mm.
Yeah, objectifying them.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's no connection.
And, people don't want connection. And you know what, Joe? If you had $1 billion, you could indulge almost anything you want without a connection. That's the thing that, you know, this character down here who really screwed, it was the very first company to really come under. I've forgotten the name of it, but it was in the news some time ago. Anyway, he would spend $50,000 on a dinner for his most important contact. $50,000.
Yeah.
So
how can you spend that? You know, I mean, how can anyone charge $50,000 for a dinner? Like, what sort of a dinner is this dinner? You know, 1 year's wages for one dinner. It's ridiculous.
This,
you know,
well, we all say it's ridiculous, and we all agree it's ridiculous, but this country is doing it.
Your country is ridiculous.
I know. You know, yeah. Even I share that, but yours is not so ridiculous because you have a huge amount less money, my dear.
Yeah, but, well, Jenny Reinhardt.
You have less influence.
Yeah, but we still have worship of the mighty dollar.
Like children who have the power to destroy you.
Say that again. I talked over you and I didn't hear you.
We're like children who have the power to destroy you.
That's right. It's absolutely ridiculous. But there must be a lot of altruism and goodness still functioning because it's made up of humans and every human has this goodness in them.
Hey, Jill.
All mammals.
Very true.
Hey, Jill.
Yeah. Yes, Stephen.
You know, statistically, the poorest people over here in America, especially, I'm not sure about elsewhere, but the poorest people are the ones that give the most to charities and just everything. Like,
because they have the empathy, they understand the need, and they also know what it's like that they can survive without it.
Whatever they can give, because they understand it. These people that we're referring to, the Goldman Sachs, Bank of America types, have no concept of humanity, compassion, or altruism. I'm their parents for that.
Well, this is the thing.
This process can only be changed. You wrote me this email, Jill, about raising money to do a tour of Australia.
I don't know if you read that properly. I was saying there were two ways of going about it.
Jill, let him.
Anybody at all.
Say it again.
I've done that all my life, and I'm not going to do it. But what I'm going to do is say that opportunity is available to you. You're going to have to raise the money for it. But what I'm saying is, unless we change to an altruistic perspective, our world is in very bad shape. I don't care about Tibetan Buddhism or being empty or being able to be psychokinetic or telepathic or any of that stuff. I'm interested in the reality of survival in this world. Buy yourself the New York Times tomorrow, Jill, and read it from cover to cover. Don't read the Sunday version because you'll be overwhelmed by the intellectual nature of New York City. Buy an ordinary newspaper. You will see the most horrifying degradation of ordinary people on every page of that newspaper.
Really?
Yes. And so what I'm going to do, and I'm saying this to your group and you, I'm spending the rest of my life trying to do what I can to change that. I'm not that old, but I'm healthy. And I'm active, and I'm skilled, and that's what I'm going to do.
You've got what it takes.
I have the knowledge that altruism is an essential part of this. but I'm going to push it. I think it can overcome greed, can overcome envy, it can overcome contempt, it can overcome coldness and inhumanity. I think it really can. In the United States of America, parents have no idea of that. I have people who work in schools whose husbands are billionaires, and they're very nice people, but they have no concept of altruism. None.
It's interesting. How do you differentiate between altruism and compassion?
Compassion, to me, is a state of mind. I don't think you could learn it. I think it, as the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh said, it happens to you. It's not something you're taught. You just see it as necessary. That's compassion. I think altruism is much more practical. It's not just a state of mind you have towards the humanity. It's a way you act towards people who don't have what they need to survive.
Okay, so you're saying that compassion is a feeling and altruism is an action.
Yes.
Right, right, okay, that makes sense. And so what you've really been saying, because we're coming to the end of the time now, I think, Stephen, are we? How much longer do we have, Stephen? About 5 minutes? What you're really saying, Stuart, is that, well, I mean, I know what you're saying. I don't know if I'm doing a proper summary here, is that we do need to have a culture change. And we do need to have a culture change. I actually think compassion can be, even though it's innate, I also think that we can actually teach ways, and I'm sure you agree with me, to take away the obscurations to seeing our natural compassion, compassion arising. And so what you've been doing in the schools with altruism, I read your paper last night, and I've actually spent a fair bit of this article trying to go through to the bits that I highlighted it, and you were saying about emphasizing the philosophy and the mindset of pragmatic altruism, which is translated into appropriate language. And the language needs to be appropriate to the profession that's actually dealing with the altruism. So that example of the police was an appropriate sort of action language, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Majority
of police, when they start off, are very altruistic.
Yes.
They're protective. They're idealistic. They want to help people. And then when they go through police training and then go on to the street,
yes,
for a period of years, they become completely disillusioned.
Yeah, that's right.
I think police need to have regular altruistic training. They need to be aware that they're always helping people and that at times they will get hurt, but their job is to make sure people survive.
And this is where we...
I don't know if you stream Netflix. Do you?
I don't even know what you're talking about. No, sorry,
Netflix,
I don't...
Netflix is a movie channel that allows you to pick movies to watch.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, one of these movies is called Hack.
Yes.
H-A-C-K. And it's about a taxi driver in New York City who used to be a policeman.
Yes.
And he can't give up the role of helper. So when he gets people that need help in his cab, he helps them.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful example of altruism in action. It's called Hack.
Hack.
Yeah.
It'd be a good thing to see. This is how you change your children.
What?
Sorry, Stuart. We keep talking over each other a lot today.
Don't worry.
What I'm saying
is... Well, we're at the hour, though, Jill.
What, Stephen?
I said we're at the hour now.
Oh, okay.
You didn't didn't see the messages?
I did, but the message that you sent me said 10 minutes.
Yes.
But that was 10 minutes ago.
No. But you changed your status on Skype, so it doesn't give you messages anymore.
Oh, is that what I did?
Uh-huh.
Oh, well, I'll get rid of that. Anyway, it's time to wind up. So, in a nutshell, we need secure social collaboration, and we need and we need to value each other. And it's sort of like it's all marries together. We've got like Diotima's ladder of love, where it goes from eros to agape, and the same in our own psyche and in our relationships to each other. And it's just really a matter of choosing, I suppose, the appropriate method for expressing our interconnectedness.
Well, we also have to deal with the bad press altruism has. That it's
right.
Women do, that it's connected with religion, that it doesn't have anything to do with reality. Only holy people like Mother Teresa.
Yep.
I mean, the example of Hallmark cards is a good example.
Yep.
This Paul is very far from Mother Teresa.
Okay, well, I'm going to...
The Ronald McDonald House.
That's right, yeah.
Through America for years, it takes care of people who visit their very sick relatives free of charge.
Yep.
Even McDonald's, which is probably one of the most damaging food industries in the country, has the idea that it can help people. And it does. I'm not suggesting McDonald's is good. I'm just suggesting that altruism is part of life. It just needs to be more center-focused, not just something you do to improve your sales, which is why I think McDonald's does it. I don't think Hallmark Card does it that. I think they do it because they are altruistic. So there's a good example. Hallmark and McDonald's are two different organizations. One does it because they're altruistic. One does it to make money. And frankly, I don't care if they make money or not. But in the end, it's going to have to be because they want the community to improve. Under the Goldman Sachs Bank of America rule, this community is going to fold. What can I say?
Yeah. Unless we have more, unless we say, you're just saying we need to change the culture. The culture is too money-oriented, and basically we need to marry all aspects of society.
Yes, we do. And it's been another great show again, Dr. Twumlow.
Yeah.
It has been, hasn't it, Jill?
Yes, it has.
Well,
so, Professor Twumlow,
we have to finish now. where I am next week. I'm not going to be here, but I will be in... As potential, I can be in touch with you at 4 o'clock, but it will be Eastern time.
Okay. I'll let Jill wrap up first, though, Dr. Twumlow.
Professor Stuart Twumlow, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much. And Stephen Roberts, thank you both very much. Good night.
You're welcome, Jill.
Thanks, Stephen.